Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 9th, 2016, 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin shared this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 7, Trading and Investment Practices Affecting Hedge Funds. Rainey Doyle, David Sirignano, and Amy Natterson Kroll will discuss shareholder activism, developments in the bad actor rules, and other market developments. Now, on to the podcast.
My name is David Sirignano. To my right, your left, is Rainey Doyle. And to my left is Amy Kroll. We are all partners in the Washington, D.C. office. Rainey and I do corporate finance work, and Amy is a trading markets broker-dealer lawyer. Ronnie's going to start off discussing some activist shareholder issues.
I'm going to talk about activism. We're all reading about it in the papers, and we're experiencing it perhaps. It continues to be, though, of high interest to all of our clients and friends, so I'll just review what's happening this year. I think we can still categorize activist investors into three general categories. We have the value-oriented operational activists, which are seeking to improve company performance in any number of ways, whether it's doing the old-fashioned thing of seeking an increase in dividends or a share buyback or a change in strategy of the corporation, a spin-off transaction, an M&A, a split-off. We have those. We have the governance-oriented activists, which are looking generally to change the board composition, perhaps also to change management, or to change governance provisions that are not shareholder friendly, for example, to deal with anti-takeover provisions. And then the third category that we see are these social responsibility oriented activists, which are seeking companies to address things like climate change, human rights issues. So they all have different goals, but the way that they get in place is the same. What we are also seeing is that the growth environment, the factors behind the growth environment, are just continuing to drive growth in the field. We have more activists. They have more money, more assets under management. There's certainly more interest in these kinds of situations. And I think shareholders in general, even the non-activist ones, are not willing to stay on the sidelines, and they're willing to show teeth a little earlier than we've seen before. So some of us question whether we're, for now, entering into a kind of a new normal where activism is something that we're going to be dealing with all the time. The playbook this year versus last year is probably just a little bit more sophisticated. I think people are getting bored with, like, again, the simple spin-offs, get a dividend, and are looking to do more complex changes within a corporation. That's also partly because companies themselves are looking at what they need to do to avoid activist situations, and so they're kind of taking matters into their own hands, which is helpful to them. Some of the regulatory developments, we didn't have a chance to talk about this last year because it's brand new. There's a bill that someone put up, well, someone named Brokaw. It's called the Brokaw Act. Some of the things in here are fairly standard. We've heard them before. One is to change the 13D initial filing deadline, move it up from 10 days to 2 days. We've heard this before. This picks up something in the Dodd-Frank Act. But then there are some significant other proposals of this act. For example, there's a provision in the bill that calls for so-called wolf packs to be defined as one person for purposes of the beneficial ownership test. And the bill actually uses the term wolf packs, which is, you know, is loosely defined as a set of funds which technically don't constitute a group under Section 13, but are targeting the same company. By defining entities as a group when today they don't technically constitute one would be a very big change. They would also have companies disclosing short interests if they exceed 5%, and also there would be a provision that would call for pecuniary interest to be recognized as beneficial ownership. That picks up on something also from the Dodd-Frank Act, where derivatives would come into how you calculate beneficial ownership. I haven't heard much about the Brokaw Act. When it first was put up, there were a bunch of articles about it. Since then, there's been a little bit of radio silence. Certainly, Congress is showing that it itself is an activist again and again. The SEC, what are they doing now? They're still looking at the same thing as they always did. They're looking at 13Ds. Are they being filed on time? Are amendments being filed on time? Are you switching from a D to a G on time? And obviously, all the factors that cause you to file, amend, or switch require careful attention. The SEC is also very well aware of the desire that comes from all facets to shorten the 13D timeline. So we'll see where they go with that.
I guess we should say then the decks are in the spiral bound document since we don't have a remote.
There's a slide in there that talks about beneficial ownership. I'm not going to go through that because I think we all understand the definition. In terms of group, I think we also understand the group definition. But one thing I kind of want to review that I think is just helpful is that practices have developed that we all are somewhat familiar with. You know, are you in a group? Well, in general, a pre-existing relationship is not enough to put you in a group. Having discussions, whether it's with other shareholders, with management, is not enough. Meetings is not enough. Sharing certain rights under certain agreements by itself is not enough. When you're having meetings, when you're doing things with other people, talking to management, it still is nevertheless a good idea to use the magical language that you would in such a setting to say, look, we're not intending to form a group, we're just having some talks. It's a little bit of a prophylactic thing, but nevertheless, it's the practice that we think works. And what are the indicia that give rise to the possible existence of a group? That's when you have coordinated activities, you're coordinating consultations, there's parallel trading in the same securities. It's when you are using common agents, common counsel, you're entering into identical agreements with respect to the same securities, or when you're making representations about the ability to influence or control shares held by others. Again, the Brokaw Act kind of would mess this up a little if they move towards changing the definition of a group. Group status is still something that we get calls on all the time, and just knowing the rules of the road is very helpful. Talking about what puts you on a D, again, we're all very familiar with what is control intent. The SEC 1996 release has some helpful facts. I won't read them because they're in your deck. But in general, if you're doing a solicitation to foster a governance-related matter, probably is fine for you to stay on a G. If, on the other hand, you're going to oppose a management proposal, it's going to put you on a D. Talking of, what's a solicitation? Again, just calls on this all the time. A solicitation is when you're asking someone for a proxy, where you want to seek the power to act. You're also doing a solicitation when you're asking someone to execute or not execute a proxy, or when you're asking someone to revoke a proxy. And what's not a solicitation? Well, what's not a solicitation is when you're going to just tell people how you're going to vote and why. Now, for those of us who have people that are involved in these types of discussions, whether with other shareholders or with management, it's important to make sure that they remember the rules of the road in terms of what's a solicitation and what's not. Because sometimes people could inadvertently cross the road into solicitation land. It's not always clear. For example, a Just Vote No campaign. That's somewhat in a gray area, depending on how I think you put out your solicitation. Fortunately, there are two rules, again, longstanding rules, that provide exemptions from the need to have a proxy on file before you do a solicitation. One is where you're making a solicitation to fewer than 10 people, which is extremely helpful if share ownership in a company is concentrated in the hands of a few people. The other exemption is where, once again, you're not seeking a proxy. So you're going to do something which will potentially be a solicitation. It's a writing, and in that case, you're allowed to do that. You can go and try and influence other shareholders. You're not going to seek a proxy, but remember that if you have more than $5 million market value in the target, the subject, the company that's the subject of the solicitation, you're going to have a requirement to file that written solicitation with the SEC and the relevant exchange within 3 days of your first use of that written material. Oral solicitations are not captured under the rule. These are important rules of the road, I think, to remember. So what are hot 13D issues? I think we can kind of skip them. They're the same as they were last year. Just remember the SEC is looking as people engage in communications, including by using new venues and forms of communication, social media and whatnot. I can promise you the SEC is on top of that, and they're looking really at everything companies are doing on both sides. And I want to also talk about something that we did not talk about last year, but it is a year-old situation, and that's just remembering how does Hart-Scott-Rodino come into all of this. Hart-Scott-Rodino has what's called the investment-only exemption, and that exempts from the waiting period acquisitions of less than 10% of a public company's stock, no matter if the purchase amount goes over the transaction threshold, which I think is currently around $76 million. But you can only avoid those requirements if your acquisition is, quote unquote, solely for the purpose of investment, which, you know, is defined as, you know, not having an intent to participate in the formulation, determination, or direction of the basic business decisions of the issuer. And Hart-Scott-Rodino regulations that are longstanding also specifically identify some categories of what would not constitute investment-only activities. They are when you nominate a candidate to a board, when you ask a third party about his or her interest to serve in a board or management position, where you propose a corporate action that requires shareholder approval, where you're soliciting a proxy, all things like that. So this is kind of the rule of the road. But what happened that was kind of interesting last year, maybe you're familiar with this situation, a bunch of funds started to take soft actions, not quite getting to those specific actions of actual decisions. Who are we going to nominate? Who are we going to propose? What are we going to do? The funds in question had communications with third parties about their potential interest to serve, but didn't communicate that to the company. They wrote letters to the company indicating that some of their own representatives might be willing to join the board. More tentative than that list of things I just went down. Anyway, the government, the DOJ, and the FTC didn't find them, but sued them and on the same day settled with them, not seeking any monetary fines, but making them promise to never do those kinds of actions ever again for the next 5 years because they said it violated the investment-only exclusion. So some people say that this went a little too far, that really what the FTC should be caring about is competition, not so much this passive-active issue. But it does tie into, you know, the analysis that you would do in terms of Section 13. So what can we expect for the coming year? I think we can expect more of the same, increased sophistication, increased activity. I think we have 400 activists that are identifying themselves as such, 550 activist situations last year, 140 billion managed by these activists now. And I think those numbers are much higher than the year before. And even though the market hasn't been that great and the performance of these activists hasn't been fabulous either, nevertheless, the interest is there, so we'll keep seeing that.
Thank you. I'm going to be spending a little time discussing some of the recent developments in the general solicitation, pre-existing substantive relation space. I think it's important to this crowd, both as issuers in raising funds, as well as investors. I never thought I'd be talking about this issue again because the 2011 Jobs Act, which instructed the SEC to get rid of the general solicitation prohibition, and the 2013 adoption by the SEC of Rule 506C was supposed to put an end to this. I would never have to spend hours on the phone counseling clients anymore about how long they have to have had a client before they can introduce them to a particular fund and things like that. But that didn't happen that way. People still focused on 506B, the legacy provision that still contains the prohibition on general solicitation. And 506C really hasn't taken off that much. In terms of number of transactions reported on Form D that are relying on 506C versus 506B, 506B is outpacing it by about 10 to 1. In terms of dollar amounts, it's about 20 to 1. So it's still 506B is the more favored provision. There may be a couple of reasons for that. One has been the additional requirements of 506C, particularly the requirement to take steps to verify not the accredited investor status of investors, not just have a reasonable basis to believe that they're accredited investors. At the same time, they adopted 506C, the SEC proposed some changes to the Form D filing requirements that a lot of people thought were draconian. Just as an example, you had to file 10 days in advance of starting your solicitation, a great way to get caught in a trap. So people decided, well, we're not going to use 506C because we may have to drop it because we don't want to live with these changes. That may be less of a concern today because I think most people believe those proposals are dead letter, but that historically may explain some of the reluctance to adopt 506C. I think at least for the last 10 months or so, since August of 2015, when the SEC put out new guidance on what is a general solicitation and how you avoid that by having a pre-existing substantive relationship, there's a lot less reason to rely on 506C. In fact, I would say that had the guidance that I'm going to talk about been out in 2011, we wouldn't have 506C because it would not be necessary. Last August, the SEC put out a no-action letter and some interpretations they put on their website and their CDIs addressing these issues. In a nutshell, it focused on the ability of intermediaries, but not broker-dealer, not registered investment advisors, but just platforms, special-purpose vehicles that would qualify investors before introducing them to a particular investment. So these entities would invest in a particular private company in a particular private offering, and the sponsors of these entities would pre-qualify investors before introducing them to a particular SPV. And the interpretations address things like angel networks, investor networks, and those type of things. And a couple of themes came out of both the letter and the interpretations. One, the notion of having a minimum period between the qualification process and the offering process is disclaimed now. The SEC said it's the quality of the relationship, not the amount of time that it's existed. So that certainly makes it a lot easier to approach investors who are just recently qualified. None of these letters talk about any real client relationship. Clients are the investment advisors, the client on a broker-dealer. I personally think that the traditional no-action letters defining pre-existing relationship envisioned a broker-dealer relationship. But that doesn't seem to be the case anymore, or investment advisory relationship. And there doesn't have to be any substantive dealings. The first transaction with these new prospects can be the private placement. They don't have to show that you've dealt with them in the past. So I think that greatly facilitates establishing a pre-existing substantive relationship. The guidance is essentially that you have to have a robust process and not just a check-the-box certification that I'm a credit investor, not just filling out a questionnaire, but some kind of dialogue with the prospect so that the promoter or sponsor can get a reasonable basis to believe that this person is both an accredited investor and suitable for this type of investor. And if that's the case, that person can be introduced to any offering post-qualification. It probably doesn't help a fund or fund manager to go out and directly qualify investors and then talk about participating in an ongoing or offering, because the idea is you still have to separate the qualification process from the offering process, and you as the issuer, where you're really offering only your own securities, that probably doesn't work, but it certainly will facilitate these type of intermediaries, these platforms, because you can go right to the platform and get introduced to the platform participants, even though they're only qualified the day before. And I think that would be very helpful. I think it's going to be very helpful in the your ability to approach independent financial advisors to be able to sell to their clients. The existing guidance out there before last August was that you had to have a pre-existing relationship with that advisor. It had to be out there for like a year. They actually wrote the time period in that letter. And then that advisor had to have a pre-existing relationship with its clients that you wanted to approach. And then the letter said another, likewise a year. And it made it very tough to access those FA clients. But I think today, under this guidance, if a financial advisor has a new client, that financial advisor could recommend your fund to that client immediately. And you don't really need to have a pre-existing relationship with these intermediaries. And the investor network interpretations and the angel network interpretations, there's no mention of how you establish a pre-existing relationship with the network. It just talks about how the network establishes a pre-existing relationship with its members. So I think that's very encouraging. Like I said, if this was around in 2011, we wouldn't have 506C. Let me just briefly give you something to look forward to, a development that was part of the FAST Act last December, a huge transportation bill. The Congress adopted, took the time to also amend the Securities Act. And one of the things they did was put in Section 4A7, which is an exemption from registration for resales of restricted or non-public securities, so long as the conditions of the section are met. One way to look at this is Rule 144 Cap A was adopted to establish a secondary market in restricted or private company securities among qualified institutional buyers, large institutions. And it was very successful in doing that in what followed were liquid secondary markets in restricted 144A securities. The goal here is to do the same thing with all restricted securities, but now only on an accredited investor level. It's essentially a codification of a concept that some of you may be aware of, the 4-1.5 concept, essentially saying that if the issuer could sell to this buyer in this context, so could an affiliate or some other holder of a restricted security, even though there wasn't a statutory provision that directly addressed that scenario. There's no reason why you couldn't have an exempt private resale. And that's been the law, L-O-R-E, for many years. People write opinions on that. It's no problem. But it's very much a one-off, restricted, negotiated type context. I think the goal here is to develop a liquid market in these private company restricted securities, and we'll see what happens. There are certain conditions. You can only sell to accredited investors, so it's very much like the private offering context. There can be no general solicitation, but no problem. The sponsor of the private market will qualify all these people before they're allowed to participate in the market. So you can just sell right into the market without even knowing who you're selling to. If it's a private company, the issuer has to provide current financial information. So that kind of turns it into somewhat of a listing type scheme. The issuer has to cooperate and volunteer to have their securities listed. That may be what slows this down, because to date, private company issuers have not been willing to allow for that type of liquidity. They want to have more control over liquidity events and who can sell and when and how much. So we'll see if that's a problem. There's other weird things, like if you're an affiliate selling, you have to certify that the issuer is in compliance with the federal securities laws. Who knows what that means? And it can't be a brand new issuance. The class of securities that you're trying to sell has to be outstanding for, I believe, 6 months. We'll see what happens. It certainly lends itself more to a platform trading market scenario than the traditional negotiated large affiliate selling a block to somebody. But the traditional 4-1.5 is still there. People will still write opinions based on the old standards. And so it doesn't really take away anything. It just potentially adds a new avenue for liquidity.
A few things to take away, not from the issuer perspective, but from the trading and the regulatory side particularly. The first is bad actor disqualification. A bad actor disqualification results in an issuer not having unavailable the 506 exemption in order to sell the securities. And so obviously that significantly impacts many of you that rely on Rule 506. The question is, who's a bad actor and when do you become a bad actor? Briefly, the three that most likely would impact this group would be if the issuer were the subject of an action that triggered the bad actor disqualification, a promoter, an investment manager, or a paid solicitor. So if you ever hear that any of your marketers, your paid solicitors, are potentially going to be the subject of an enforcement action or have been the subject of an SEC enforcement action, have been the subject of an injunctive action, or the subject of a criminal action, the critical thing is to find out if they have a waiver. If there's a waiver, then the disqualification goes away and they can act on your behalf in marketing, selling your funds. Similarly, if the advisor of a fund or the issuer itself is going to be the subject of an action that would trigger disqualification, talk waivers as part of settlement talk waivers as part of settlement with whichever regulator it is that is going to be bringing the action in order to forestall any disqualification that would preclude reliance on Rule 506. Would just like to mention an issue, as Ronnie was mentioning, some of these are from last year, but they still remain current. Short selling in connection with a public offering, Rule 105 under the SEC's Regulation M, remains an issue of attention. When the Office of Compliance Inspections and Examinations comes in to visit, they're going to ask to see short sales versus receipt of allocations in secondary offerings. Rule 105 prohibits the receipt of allocations if short positions have been put on in that name during a restricted period prior to the secondary offering. There are some exceptions that are available. It may be that some of the trades fall within those exceptions, in particular the bona fide purchase exception that says if you've effectively cleared out your short positions more than 24 hours prior to the pricing of the offering, then you can receive an allocation. But otherwise, compliance with Rule 105 is going to remain a subject of attention. And if OC finds that there are short sales and allocation, receipt of allocations during a restricted period, then there is going to be enforcement attention as well. Just as a note, the SEC has settled more than 45 actions against funds, against individuals, against broker-dealers, against advisors, to the tune of $30 million. One last thing to mention is that FINRA has issued to its members report cards on spoofing and layering. These are cross-market equity supervision report cards, and they are not just being made available, but they've been provided to firms, as it turns out. Firms are supposed to use these to identify spoofing and layering. What are spoofing and layering? Spoofing is when you enter an order to entice another market participant to come into the market at a price that where that other participant would not ordinarily trade, and then you take advantage of that by trading against those orders. Layering is entering limit orders with the intent to move the market and obtain a beneficial execution on the other side of the market. FINRA is going to be examining its members to see what they're doing with the information that FINRA has provided. That means that FINRA is going to be coming to the buy side to ask about potentially suspicious activity that might constitute spoofing and layering so that the sell side can show FINRA how vigorous they're being in order to forestall their being found to have facilitated these problematic trades. With that, I think we're done. Thank you.
Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2016 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius, LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.